Hi, and welcome to the next episode of TransPerfect Life Science Talks. I'm your host, Mark Wade. I'm the practice leader here at TransPerfect Life Science in the COA practice. Today, I'm joined by Kate Williams. Kate is the Senior Director of Patient-Centered Outcomes at Ancaster Lloyd, and she's also the incoming chair of the Clinical Outcome Assessment Special Interest Group at ISPOR.
Kate, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Mark. Great to be here.
Great. Now, before we begin, I have a captive audience and I'm going to take advantage of it. Kate is the incoming chair of the COA, Clinical Outcome Assessment Special Interest Group, which I'm a member of as well, full disclosure. I've been a member for years, as you have, Kate. So now I have you as a captive audience. If I may just, before we get into the podcast, can I just ask a couple of questions regarding that? Because I'm keen to see what your vision is for the future, and I'm kind of interested to see what your take is. How are you going to bring it back to its glory? And what is your view for the future?
Great, sure. So I think there's a couple of things we need to do initially. So the first one being that I think we need more collaboration across the whole of ISPOR. So I think, as often happens in our fields, we obviously, we're clinical outcome assessment researchers and we work a lot with other CER researchers. But ISPOR is obviously a large organisation with health economists, HDA specialists, people from lots of different disciplines. And I think we need to collaborate more across the organization to try and really get the value of COA and COA research more widely known. So for example, I've been at conferences recently where I've seen presentations on from say like HDA experts or health economists talking about the new novel methods of qualitative research, for instance. And obviously any COA researcher kind of watching those presentations knows this is something we've been doing for years, but obviously we're sort of not getting that research out there and not collaborating. So obviously there's expertise we have that we could potentially bring to those other groups and likewise. So I think collaborating more with other special interest groups, but also other councils within ISPOR is one of the first things I'd like to do. In addition, I think member engagement is really key. So we're one of the largest SIGs within ISPOR, and we have a lot of expertise within the COA SIG, but I think member engagement is still quite limited. Typically, we're at the moment, and often that's the only sort of touch point members have. So I really want to do more to engage the members throughout the year. So to do that, we're kind of looking at trying to have an open meeting in person at each ISPOR conference, so at ISPOR Annual in Montreal. We're also, as many members will know, we're in the process of identifying a key project, which we hope to get members involved in. So actually getting on with a good research project. So once we've selected that, we'll obviously be putting a call out for members to get involved with that. And then other member engagement activities. So we've now got a new committee of new member engagement co-chairs, and they're engaging the members. So things like webinars, getting people involved in those, and journal clubs and other opportunities like that. So I think that's what I'm hoping to be doing.
I think that, no, and I welcome that, because from my point of view, selfishly, on the translation and cultural adaptation front, if you look at the guidelines that we use, they were driven out. I'm not going to show my age, Kate. I'm not going to show my age, but they were driven out a long, long time ago from the ISPOR. I'm encouraged to hear that, because there has been a dearth of output, I think, to be honest. And the output you're talking about is going to engage our fellow members. So thank you for that. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to our next meeting. Let me change gear. Let's go into our podcast, because I think our podcast is actually going to be very exciting. Full disclosure again, we have touched on this before in another episode in the podcast. But I'd like your take on it. So if I may, can I just ask you to set the table, define it, why we do it, you know, basic people out there like me.
Sure. Yeah. So, as you say, I'd like to talk a bit today about qualitative research, and particularly in rare disease. So for those who sort of aren't familiar with the topic, so qualitative research is a research method that involves an in-depth exploration of people's experiences. So in comparison to, say, quantitative research, which typically involves generating numerical data, for example, the proportion or number of individuals who experience a symptom, qualitative research gives you much richer data in the form of patient descriptions of their experience, and that's usually like reported in quotes. So you get a much more in-depth look at the experience. And so typically, just to orient your listeners, so when we're talking about qualitative research, we're typically talking about interviews with patients, perhaps caregivers, sometimes clinicians as well. There are other methods as well, such as focus groups. And I know there are also different types of interviews. You obviously had Tom Wilgos on your podcast previously to talk about interviews.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we're talking about with qualitative research. And also just sort of people working in the field of patient reported outcomes and clinical outline PRO guidance and in the more recent sort of PFDD guidance. But I think its value isn't always recognized as much as it could be. So I kind of wanted to take the opportunity to talk a bit more about it today.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk about why rare disease is the perfect example of why that is, this is where its sweet spot is. You and I, we've actually both talked previously around Duchenne's disease. It's been on our podcast a couple of times. Can you talk about why it's so relevant in rare disease?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, very good question. So qualitative research is particularly important in rare disease because these are populations where so little is known about the burden of disease. So if you conduct qualitative interviews with patients or caregivers in this population, you're really giving a sort of unheard community a voice, essentially, because often there's literally nothing published for a lot of rare diseases. And this can sort of really help highlight the burden of disease and therefore the sort of unmet need with regard for treatments. And often in these diseases, there are no treatments. So it's really important to sort of be able to illustrate what that experience looks like and why it's so important that there is sort of research into new treatments. Also, with a small sample, as you often have with rare diseases, because by their very nature they're rare, qualitative research can actually be more informative than quantitative research, because if there's a lot of heterogeneity and the small sample, as you say, it can often be quite difficult to get meaningful quantitative data to be able to draw meaningful comparisons. But that qualitative data can give you really like rich descriptions and give you a much better understanding of what's going on in those populations.
And that in itself leads to, in my opinion, some significant challenges, because now we're getting open text. And by the way, for all of us in COA world, in ECOA world, that is, you know, almost counterintuitive. So could you talk to me about the challenges around gathering this data and the challenge of, by the way, parsing this data into a meaningful piece of useful data in a study?
Sure. I mean, yeah, there are lots of challenges. Obviously, this data is valuable, but there are lots of challenges with conducting qualitative research in rare disease. And one of them being recruitment. Obviously, we're talking rare diseases, there are obviously limited number of individuals to reach. So it can be difficult to recruit. And I'll talk about some of the ways in which I think we can try and sort of do that better. Often the nature of the diseases means it's difficult for participants to take part in interviews. So for example, some rare diseases have people experience cognitive impairments or physical impairments, which can make taking part in an interview difficult. So in those cases, we often need to talk to the caregivers. But by the very nature of being a caregiver for someone with a severe condition, they obviously have a lot of competing demands on their time. And so it can be difficult to sort of find time to take part in an interview or a focus group or something like that. From a research perspective and some of the challenges that sort of can come up particularly people working in industry may see like pushback from their internal colleagues who maybe fail to recognize the value of qualitative research and what it can bring. Often see sort of pushback on things like, oh, there's such a small sample size. Can we get people want to see numbers and statistics? So I think it can often be difficult for people conducting research, particularly in industry, to sort of get the value sort of known.
Can I unpack that slightly? I know we haven't talked about this, but I'm interested in this. So the stakeholders in industry sometimes don't see the value. Have you had experience where you've actually got them to see the light, got them to see the real value? Has there been situations like that? I know we haven't talked about this, by the way.
Yeah, sure. I think this is where how you communicate it's important. So I think people often see, oh, small sample size, are you powered to do that? And you get those kinds of questions. But in terms of showing the value, I think when you actually get the qualitative data and you see the quotes from the patients or the caregivers highlighting that experience, that can really have an impact. So, for example, we've done some research in Duchenne, as you mentioned, and this is a condition where, so this is for those who aren't aware, it's a rare neuromuscular disease that predominantly affects boys. And quite a lot was already known about the kind of clinical signs and symptoms of the disease. There's quite a bit published on that from like the clinician perspective, but there wasn't really anything published from the kind of on the actual experience of the disease and what it means to live with the disease. So we conducted a qualitative study, which was conducted with caregivers because it was predominantly children that we were was the population we were focused on, and they and we not only looked at kind of the sort of explored the sort of signs and symptoms of the disease, but looked at how that impacted their life. And the data we got from that means to live with Duchenne. So, for example, we had one caregiver who was talking about how their son misses out on so much because he wants to go to like children's birthday parties, and he's physically impaired and struggles to walk and gets fatigued easily. So he's not going to be able to, say, go on a bouncy castle and have that experience that his peers have. So having those kind of quotes and being able to show those to different audiences, that really kind of brings to life like what the experience is. And I think that can be quite impactful and help people sort of see what qualitative can add.
Do you add the interviews for the caregivers? Because I think caregivers are often... The stress and the burden on them is enormous. I know from experience, the burden is enormous. And we forget it. So do you get data from them as well? And can that data be useful in an argument?
Sure. I mean, very, very good question. I know you had Andrew Lloyd on here to talk about caregivers as well. Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So in this particular population, as I said, we were talking to caregivers and we were able to use those interviews. So in those interviews, we asked them about the impact on patients, but we also asked them about the impact on themselves. So we got a lot of rich data from a single interview. So we got all the details on like the patient experience, how it impacts their life, but also like what the caregiver experience looks like and then how that impacts their own quality of life. And this all provides like rich data on the sort of overall burden of the disease, which can be very useful for different stakeholders to really understand what the sort of knock-on impact can be on the caregivers and families too.
I think that's a great point. Let's change gears for a sec, because now we've set the table. We know what the challenges are. I would like to look at solutions, or not solutions, or certainly strategies that you have engaged in your career. So simple things like maximizing this small data set. What do we do with these? Because they're small data sets. What do we do with them?
Sure. So I mentioned obviously with Duchenne, we looked at in the caregiver interviews, we looked at the patient experience and the caregiver experience. We've also done some work in a condition called AADC deficiency. So this is another rare neurological disease that affects children. And I think this is a really good example of how we really maximized that data. So obviously, as we say, people have competing demands on their time. They don't have a lot of time to participate in research. It's a very small patient population. So what we did with this study, we wanted to look at the patient experience and how living with this condition impacted their life. We also wanted to know how it impacted caregivers. And to take that a step further as well, so the people we were working with were developing an economic model to try and get a new treatment to market. And that economic model had various different health states in. And as is often the way with economic models, there were utility values associated with each of those health states. But in terms of communicating that to different stakeholders, such as clinicians, what does a utility value mean? What does that mean to live in that health state? That wasn't really known. So what we did is we conducted a questionnaire with the caregivers, and that allowed us to categorize the patients into the different health states that were in this economic model. And that meant we were able to chop up our qualitative data and describe the experience of living in the different health states. So as well as having that qualitative data on the entire sample, what it looks like to live with the disease, we were able to say, to sort of describe what the experience looked like living in different health states. So a more mild state and a more severe state. And this meant we could really sort of show like, this is why it's so important that patients don't. So this was a degenerative condition. So we were able to show this is why it's so important that patients don't progress from this more mild state to this more severe state. So it was a nice way of illustrating kind of what it meant to live in the different health states.
Did you publish that, by the way?
And yeah, that is published.
Okay. After this podcast, I think actually what I might do is I might tag on that a link to that piece of publication, if I may. Because that's quite interesting. What other things can we do, though? Can we, you know, I want to parse the whole, how do we disseminate that? How do we distill that down to a meaningful bolus of data that we can give to and prove to regulators that this is useful? How do we do that? It seems counterintuitive.
Sure. I mean, there's different ways of collecting qualitative data. So obviously, I've talked a bit about interviews.
Yeah.
But sometimes in very rare diseases, it can be beneficial to take an even more kind of open approach and sort of go back to sort of just very open questions to understand the experience. So if there's literally nothing known and you almost don't know what to put in an interview guide, one method we've tried is like a narrative approach exercise. And what this has involved is getting patients or caregivers to just write freely about their experience and what's important to them. So they get given very simple instructions, just literally tell us about what it's like to live with this condition or to care for someone living with the condition. And they can just write freely anything they want. If they're unable to write, we've also done it with where they can voice note and just send us a sort of free recording. And that can be particularly useful. I mean, it can be beneficial for the participant because they can do it in their own time. They don't have to attend an interview at a scheduled time. And that can really provide the sort of initial information for researchers on the impact of the disease. And then researchers can take that information and maybe think about then doing a more structured qualitative study, such as the ones we talked about. So you might then use that information to develop your interview guide and think about those questions.
Great. That you've joined the dots now for me, because so basically you have this large bolus of open text, and then that might inform going forward a questionnaire or the construction of more closed questions. Okay, that makes sense to me now. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, well, even more on that. So you might then do structured interviews, but then, yeah, as you've just alluded to there, so then the qualitative data you might get from a more semi-structured interview then can go into the formation of questions and development of patient-reported outcomes and such, and then you can go on to collect that quantitative data as well. So
join the dots. That makes a lot of sense. I suppose the other thing I want to ask you is, because this comes up regularly, by the way, where we have all this information, and we don't give that information back to the patients. Some patients want to see their information, some patients don't. I want to talk about the communication. What do we do now that we have this information? How do we talk to the layperson? How do we talk to the clinicians? How do we communicate this in publications? How do we communicate this in support groups? Or do we?
I mean, good question. I mean, I think traditionally, as most researchers know, like the sort of goal of a lot of research outputs is typically to get them maybe published in a manuscript in a peer-reviewed journal, or maybe you present them at a conference or something like that. And that's often the goal of the researchers. But obviously we're asking these communities to take part in our research. So we kind of owe it to them to give back and sort of communicate the findings more broadly to those kind of, to the patients and the caregivers who participate, and also to the kind of the wider patient community, so patient advocacy groups and things. So I think historically that hasn't happened a lot. It's definitely happening more. I think, yeah, particularly with the sort of move towards patient and public involvement, partnering with patient organisations, both in throughout research studies, to involve them and to collaborate with them from the beginning, and as part of that, I think working with them to sort of disseminate to the broader community, so not just through manuscripts, but also developing patient infographics or via podcasts such as like this one, or sort of basically having different like ways of communicating lay summaries to those groups. Yeah. Is obviously
and
very
that's
important.
Good. And then on the street, it's not going to read our clinical papers. They're going to read something in a journal or in a Facebook support group. Also think, in my experience, though, there are certain patients that are much more motivated than other patients. And some patients, like a great example is the MS patients that are very motivated and very, very much participants in study. And then there are other patients that are might be asymptomatic and not very motivated. So we have to get that information out to each. So I guess my question is, do we change our narrative for each like disease state kind of thing? Or do we just change our mode?
Good question. I mean, and I think this is where, again, partnering with the sort of the patient organizations is the best way to know the answers to these questions. So if we're involving patients and caregivers from the outset, that's where we kind of we're educated on these kinds of things, and we can discuss and find the best way to communicate to different audiences. So some motivated patients may be reading scientific publications, many of them are, whereas others may want sort of more accessible forms. So and obviously people have different levels of interest, and some will want shorter versions and longer versions and the rest of it.
Fair enough. Kate, thank you so much for your time today. That was great. Thank you so much. Today, I was talking to Dr. Kate Williams. She's Director of Patient-Centered Outcome Research at Acaster Lloyd. If you want to join us on the podcast, please DM me or email me, mwade@transperfect.com. Until next time, thank you so much. Bye-bye.